Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. I'm super excited about this guest because when I hear the phrase rigging the game, it's, you know, it excites me because I believe the game is rigged. And if we can fight back at any level, I think that that is a must. As an entrepreneur, we can take control of our financial legacy. And so you have to realize that there is a game being played, maybe many games. And if you can position yourself to win and act accordingly, you have a good chance of creating generational wealth. So the book we're talking about today is called Rigging the Game: How to Achieve Financial Certainty, Navigate Risk, and Make Money on Your Terms. We have the author today, Dan Nicholson. Thanks so much for being here, sir.
Hey, super excited to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I get a little jealous. Anybody who rivals my background, all right, I gotta say, it's not often I see this, but great background. You have an awesome, you know, brand and a business. So it's going to be an exciting time to interview you, hear what you have to say. The book is doing really well on Amazon. It came out in 2022, and you're speaking our language. So what made you want to write this book?
Well, I went through all the conventional business school, Fortune 500 jobs. I could go over all the boring parts of my resume. And I had a baseline level of anxiety throughout because I was totally out of alignment with what I wanted to be doing with my life, which was being an entrepreneur. And so finally, I gave myself permission, and just to date myself, that was about 15 years ago. So I'm an old guy in the game, I guess, to some extent. But as I got into being self-employed, I realized everything I thought I knew that I learned in business school and these Fortune 500 companies doesn't work in small business. It doesn't work in personal finance. And so I had to go, it was very humbling. I had to go about kind of unlearning those principles and develop my own framework, both to be successful in my own business, but to actually help clients the way that I wanted to serve them.
Yeah. What you just said hits home with me because it was like a wake up call. Everything I learned in school was wrong. I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. It changed my perspective on what an asset was, what a liability was, how to go from one side of the quadrant, cash flow quadrant, to the other. And it was going against everything that I was taught. And some people can't handle that. It's pretty wild how it is a wake up call. It's very much like Plato's allegory of the cave, but once you see it, you can't unsee it. And it's your moral obligation to help those see what you now take for granted, I guess. But in your book, there's so much to go over. I think that I want to kind of cut to the chase. And you have, in the first part of your book, identify your biases and playing your game. And you have this a great example about, like, you know, how if this person lost $20 or lost tickets to a movie, what would that person do on average? What would you recommend them to do? And it was cool how you put that out there. And it really shows you might have a bias, an automatic response. Your subconscious is telling you how to solve problems. Being aware of it does give you an advantage. So can you tell us about identifying your biases?
Well, one of my core beliefs, and it is bared out in the science, is that we're just, by nature, we're biased. It's sort of programmed into our operating system. If you think about how many decisions we have to make over the course of a day, and there's ranges between 6,000 and 23,000, depending on what you read, just little decisions. Like right now, I just did some jazz hands. I didn't really think about the jazz hands. It just happened, right? So that was a decision. But you cross the street now as a 40-plus-year-old man, I just naturally look both ways and I'm pausing and I'm navigating life, right? And so part of our brain is this fast system. This is from the book, Thinking Fast and Slow, that we have to make these really rapid decisions to just navigate life, to be able to cross the street without stopping and thinking about the meaning of life while you're getting plowed over by a bus. So we got the fast part, and then we have the slow part, like being strategic, thinking about a math equation, working on our mindset. And so it turns out that fast part is subject to biases. It has to be. There's a set of assumptions that our brain is making for us to even exist in the world. And you can't turn that off. That's just the reality. The slow part, the mindset and the really conscious thinking, that can be improved. But as humans, we have biases. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
And some people,
and that comes from that comes from your environment when, as you grow up, right? What you've been taught, and maybe even generational DNA, where you know certain things happen to you, and it's just you, it rubbed off on you, whether you realize it or not, right?
I would, I'm 100% aligned on that whole epigenetics idea that things just pass on from one generation to another, and we can. It doesn't mean we don't work on being a better human and that we just go, I'm biased, so I get to do all this nefarious stuff. That's not what I'm saying, that we have just permission to do that. But the sooner that you recognize that you're biased as a human, you can design better systems to account for those biases. So you get better performance. You get closer to what you want. And a lot of us are fighting against that. We're throwing stones at everybody else. Like, I'm not biased. I'm rational. You're biased. It's like, no, both of you are. So stop it and own your own role in things, right? So that's what I'm an advocate for. One of those biases that you were talking about was something called the mental accounting bias. And there's a really cool study, and you can go and Google it and find an explainer video on it. But it shows that they present these two scenarios that are economically the same. One scenario is that they're going to a movie theater and they've pre-purchased the tickets. They get there and they find out that they've lost the tickets. Another scenario is they haven't pre-purchased the tickets, but they lost the physical money dollar value of the tickets. So say the tickets cost $20. In the second scenario, they lost a $20 bill.
Yep.
Rather than losing $20 worth of tickets. Economically, it's the same. $20 ticket is worth $20 physically. But there is a dramatic difference in how humans behave if they lost the $20 versus if they lost the tickets. Like, I believe it's somewhere around a 40 percentage point difference in whether or not somebody would still continue to repurchase the ticket if they lost it versus if they lost the $20.
Wow.
It's wild. And it just all comes back to the idea that the way we label things significantly changes our behavior. That's why setting up different money buckets, if you've studied, some people talk about profit first.
Of course.
And bucketing your money. The reason why things like that work is because we're labeling it differently. And our economic decision engine, sort of in our brain, behaves differently just by assigning labels.
Hmm. Yeah. So I will tell you, when I was reading that, I think I would have answered differently 10 years ago. And now I look at it and it's a different perspective. So maybe because I've been around certain people, I've read books, I've developed as a person, personal transformation, mm-hmm. I can now see it from a different angle. And I guess maybe that's, you know, I guess I could look back and say, oh, I definitely had these biases amongst these people, or how I solved problems, or my automatic responses. Mm-hmm. Now it's a little different because maybe some things have more meaning, some things have less meaning, or maybe I just understand problem solving to a higher degree. So these things do change if you focus on your development as a person. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Step one is really acknowledging that we're biased. Step two is being intentional about who you are, what you want, what problems you're trying to solve. So being able to properly characterize a problem to begin with is key. Many of us are solving the wrong problem. Just, we're not really clear on what we're doing. And so then we can start to construct a system that will work for us and help us ultimately make the best possible decision. Now, we don't always make the best possible decision. So then the last piece is, how quickly can I recognize that and then recover? So I made the wrong decision. That's fine. Most of us will continue in the wrong decision. It's called loss aversion. It's another one of these biases. So if we make a bad decision, we will stay in it longer because we don't want to have to admit that we made a decision.
Man. Now that is relevant in today's political sphere. Am I right?
100%. The best traders in the world. So the first 5 years of my career was in the derivatives, hedging, sort of capital market space. The best traders in the world recovered from losses faster. So they sold out a bit bad positions faster. Because what they understood was, I could stay down this path that isn't serving me, or there's this investment over here that if I move my money over there faster, it's going to get me back to break even sooner. And yeah. So, but most of us will bury ourselves just trying to prove that the previous decision we made was fine.
Well, that happens in relationships too, right? Or just 100%. Business vehicles. I'm in the wrong relationship, or if these individuals think to themselves they're in the wrong business, they're going to say, well, I could fix it. I could right the ship. You know what? I don't want to admit that I wasted all this time and money. I'm going to try to stay at this for as long as it takes. And that is the wrong move.
I believe that we have a belief system that sounds, there's things that we say that sound really good, but then you try to play it out and you can see where it's flawed in the extremes. So one of those key things that we might say is, I do what I say I'm going to do. It sounds really good. It's like, hell yeah, I do what I say I'm going to do. The problem is that sometimes what you said you're going to do was a bad decision. And so if you feel obligated, once I tell someone I'm going to do it, and now I have to carry it out, you might be harming yourself and the other person. So a better belief is, I reserve the right to change my mind. Right. So, and I have an obligation to tell you that. So you can guarantee that I'm either going to follow through on this thing, or if I'm not going to, I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to tell you why. It's sort of like, and I like to test these things in the extremes. So let's just pick a ridiculous extreme. Like, say you and I are going to meet up for lunch, and you get there first and you see that the restaurant is literally on fire. You're not going to go sit down and be like, well, I do what I say I'm going to do. I'm waiting for Dan, just chilling here in this like inferno. Clearly that would be ridiculous. And it would be inappropriate in the extreme for me to then get pissed off at you. Like, hey, what's up, Mike? Like, why aren't you in the restaurant? You said you're going to be there. I thought you said you do what you say you're going to do. Right. So that's a extreme. That's a literal fire. We wouldn't do that. But how many, the actual fire, but how many of these sort of metaphorical fires do we have in our business that we keep doing anyways because we told someone we're going to do it?
Man.
So discipline is answering yes to the question, would I be a disciple of myself? You're not going to be a disciple of someone who keeps repeating the same wrong decisions just because they don't have the integrity to tell someone that the pathway was wrong. It's like, I want someone who's going to do what they say they're going to do and tell me if the path is wrong, and then we're going to do something else. That, to me, is someone I would want to follow.
Man. Yeah, I mean, I would even like to look up the origin of the word disciple and how it does correlate to discipline, right? What you just said is, are you a disciple to yourself? Ah, it's a great way to put it. I've never heard anybody say it that way. Interesting.
Yeah, to me, that is, I learned that from my mentor, this guy, Randy Maskell, that so I can't take credit for it, but it rings true. And it's part of sort of my daily process of, based off today, would I say yes to would I be a disciple of myself? And if no, like, what do I need to do differently tomorrow? Because I want to say yes as many times as possible.
Yeah. Wow. It's good. And then I guess that is the one section. Playing your own game, man. I talk about this a lot on this podcast and within my mastermind. I think everybody has a different investor DNA, different personalities. Dr. Joe Dispenza, your personality equals your personal reality. My personality is different than somebody else. Warren Buffett, I look at his lifestyle, I would never want it. Yes, I want his money. I would never want his lifestyle. McDonald's, drinking Coca-Cola, sitting in an office 8 hours a day, no motorcycles, right? I mean, come on, this is not the life I want. I'm going to play my game. He plays his, and that's what I preach. So what would you add to this chapter? What's in this chapter?
A couple of personal gut punches, like, go to school on my tuition so you don't have to pay the same price. You start a business and you go, hey, I want this business because I want freedom. That's the number one thing that people tell me.
Yeah.
I want freedom. I want legacy. I'm going to define my own path. And then you talk to them on like day one or week one, and they're fired up on like, I'm going to I'm going to set this course in this future. And then you check in with them like 90 days later, like, how's it going? So I joined all these programs and I'm copying everybody else. I'm paraphrasing at this point. It's like, I'm copying all these other strategies, copying everyone. And you sort of go like, well, how could you expect to do something extraordinary when you're doing literally the ordinary? You're copying everyone else.
Mm.
It's like, that's actually designing a system that you guarantee you won't get the result that you want, because you're just conforming to literally what everyone else is doing. You're seeking consensus. And then you get burnt out, frustrated, because you're not getting the results or having the life that you want. But you necessarily can't, because you're trying to be the average of everyone else. So the better approach is to not do that. You got to play your game. You got to be who you are. Put your, and everything that you do, you have to put your unique stamp on it. In everything. So I call it, one of my principles is only innovate where you differentiate. So that means you have to actually know where you differentiate. And then in everything that you do, you can get the DNA of what other people are doing, but then put your stamp on it. How are you going to differentiate? And I can give you examples of that. I'm a CPA by trade. Don't hold that against me. And fancy myself to be unconventional. And I have joined several times accounting masterminds, which is as boring as you think it is.
Oh, geez. God bless you, man.
But not for the reason that everyone else is in there. It's like, I just want to know what you guys are doing so I can do the opposite of that.
Wow.
Like, that's why I'm in here. It's like, this is how you're doing that? Okay. Well, I want extraordinary results. So I want to see the baseline, and then I'm just going to do the opposite or some version of it that's distinct. And then you guys are like, what? Why is Dan getting these results over here? It's like, because mine is different than yours. People can't, they sniff out the fact that you're just copying what everyone else is doing.
Awesome. You join the masterminds to learn what other people are doing so you can do it at a higher level, right? Or just to do it in the opposite direction. Therefore, you stand out in the marketplace, but also you're more memorable and you have an understanding that you are different. You're not just following in line. It's great. Haven't heard that.
Yeah. There's a quote that I have, there's a statement that I have in the book that I'm paraphrasing, which I realize is a little bit egotistical to, here I am quoting myself from my own book, but I'm going to play my game and do it anyways, which is, unless you're a sociopath, how can you expect to be somebody else every day? Like, it's not a stable structure. So you got to play your own game. You've got to lean into what makes you, you. Otherwise, you're going to keep blowing yourself up, because it's just not, you're not a good enough actor.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's the reason why I failed so often early on. I mean, I had four startups that I tried at that were major failures, put me in $300,000 in debt. And then I just said, I'm shutting off all the noise. I'm going to stop doing what I think is, you know, in alignment with Steve Jobs and Wozniak. Like, I'm not those people. Let me just do something I know I can do and have my own little love and passion behind it. Maybe I'm not going to make a million, but I'll make some money. And I made money. And that's what got me a little bit of attention. Playing my game rather than the big game, if that makes sense. You know, focus on your own greatness rather than trying to create a big company.
100%. Now, the big challenge with that is people will say, I don't know what my game is. Like, how do I figure that out? And I do write about it some in the book, but I'll give you a couple of different, I'll give you one kind of tip, which is, think about your favorite sport or hobby when you were a kid. How did you play that sport or hobby? How did you show up? What was it that you liked about it? And what I find is, I use this for interviews as well to kind of get to the essence of who someone is, that unless you had super overbearing parents or there was some, you know, factor that didn't allow you to show up the way that you were, but, or wanted to show up, when you're a kid, it's like a true expression of your personality. So I always wanted to be shooting guard. I was a taller kid, so they wanted to put me on under the hoop. But in like pickup basketball, I always wanted to be shooting guard, but I'm not necessarily the most athletically gifted. So I had to make up for it with hustle and some grit. And that's how I am in business. It's like, I want to be shooting guard because I'm not afraid to take the last shot. I want the ball in my hands. Sometimes I'm going to dive on the floor. I'm going to put in maximum effort. When I'm not doing that, when I'm like playing the role of a point guard, I'm just always passing the ball, seeking consensus. What do you guys want to do? That's when I'm deeply dissatisfied in doing the work. And I usually do some sort of self-sabotage because I'm not playing my game. Now, it doesn't mean that every once in a while I need to pass the ball. I don't always need to shoot it. Like even Jordan kicked the ball to Kerr to make the three-pointer at the end. Right? It's like you still doesn't mean you always shoot it, but just knowing your tendencies and what's going to elevate your skill sets is key.
Wow. That was a great speech by Kerr. You ever hear him, his celebratory speech at the parade? Have you ever heard of that at all? He basically said,
yeah,
it's just really funny. You made me think of it because I saw it not too long ago. He's like, yeah, I had to bail Michael Jordan out again. there was a big conversation before that play that Michael Jordan kept telling the coach he was too afraid to shoot. So let's give the ball to Kerr. I mean, I'm not even a huge basketball fan, but I was howling when I was watching that. Yeah. So anyways, you're right, though. Like you just made me think of when I used to play hockey. I was not, I'm 5'7.5". All right. So totally different perspective, but I played with grit. Okay. And I played with it and I played pretty well, but it was because I was gritty. I was willing to muck it up, if you will. And it's what made me different. So what's really funny is now I think you're the first person that ever really showed me this. How I played hockey is exactly how I play business. Mm-hmm. And that's what allows me to be, I guess, better than most at business. I think that's huge.
Yeah. Playing your game and then you take this another step forward, say that you want to hire someone on your team and you're like, I really need someone who's just going to be a savage independent contributor. Like they're just going to lone wolf it. Just not growing a whole team. It's like, well, maybe you get someone who played track, tennis, golf, like these things that are individual contributor sports. Is often like that's how they also show up in their work. So you can sort of use it to also help kind of calibrate. Here's the type of person I'm looking for, or the type of role. And unlike the kind of cliche human behavioral questions that people ask, what's your greatest strength, greatest weakness, or whatever, this helps you get to the essence of their personality. And they get excited about it, start talking, start telling you stories. And then they're kind of, and then at the end, you're like, is this kind of how you are? Like, wow, I didn't know you were going there with that.
Yeah. Well, you're making me think of, I wasn't sophisticated enough to do these type of questionnaires before I hired people in the early days of my business. But you make me think of somebody who I know for a fact was a photographer. She's on my team right now. Now she's the project manager of our company. But as a photographer, she was a loner, right? She wanted to just go out, take pictures, do her own thing on her own time with her own creativity. And what's really wild about that is, I wasn't able to match that up with certain aspects of my company, but no wonder she does certain things in a certain way because she likes to be on her own. She loves to have this creativity, this freedom to problem solve, and that's sort of art to her. So it matches up. Your personality doesn't fade away. It just kind of maybe accentuates depending on the role you're in. And so let people shine based off of their personality.
Love it.
So those are two great things I want to get to. And by the way, we could talk for hours. You do have an audiobook. Is that right?
I do. Yep.
I'm going to listen to your audiobook. Very good stuff so far. But you have these commandments. Can you kind of touch on one or two that stand out? I like how you put this, the certainty commandments. Is that right?
Yeah. So when I started writing my book, I wanted to turn it into kind of an operating system for making better decisions. And in particular, better decisions for you. I could give a bunch of prescriptive strategies of here's a tax strategy, here's a financial engineering strategy. But at the end of the day, one of my commandments is understanding the difference between preference and binary. Preference versus binary. Now, I'm not talking about gender. We don't need to go there. That's a whole other thing. I don't
yeah, you're in Seattle. I'm in Pittsburgh. We may start fighting, just so you know.
This might be a whole thing. But binary, what I mean is like in the computer science, like right or wrong, zeros or ones. We have to understand the difference between a preference-based decision and a binary-based decision. Okay. What do I mean by that? And I call these commandments because if I just called them assumptions, it's like, who cares about an assumption? Like we can, but a commandment, it's like I violate a commandment. Does this put me into some sort of mortal peril? Is my life in jeopardy? So sometimes I use words that have like a linguistic meaning behind it that carries a bigger punch. So most business decisions that you're asking yourself right now are preference-based. There's not a right or wrong. They're not binary. So if I ask you why the sky is blue, there's a scientific answer for that, right? Should I grow my business? You could Google that. You're going to find thousands of articles with a bunch of different opinions, but actually only you can answer that question. But many of us are out seeking consensus. We're looking for someone to answer these questions that only we can answer because they're preferences. You're allowed to want what you want because you want it. That's it. There's really no justification for it. It's like, I hate mayonnaise. Absolutely hate mayonnaise. I think it's the worst of the condiments, and I will die on that hill. But other people, like most humans who have bad taste, are like, no, mayonnaise is a superior condiment. It's like, and they're like, why do you not? And it's so many times at dinner where people are like, what do you mean you don't like mayo or aioli? So they're like, why don't you like it? I don't know, because I don't like it. It's like a texture. And then you're like trying to get into explaining something that is just, it's like circular. I don't like it because I don't like it. And that's how that's true with many of these. Should I grow my business? Should I hire somebody? Should I, all these sort of things. It depends on what you want. Now, if you tell me what I want, my most important priority is more time with my kids. Okay. First off, I'm going to call BS on that because I watched all y'all during COVID and you didn't want more time with your kids. Yeah. Right. Like, let's get them back in school as soon as possible. Now I have two kids and love them dearly, but what I actually want is not more time with my kids. I want to be more present when I'm with my kids, which means a totally different problem. Yeah. More energy versus more time. Like, again, back to, are we solving the right problem? So first off, when you say my number one priority, I want more time with my kids, then someone like me is going to push back and go, is that what you really want? Let's make sure we're solving for the right thing. But if you go, okay, we get to the essence of it. What you want is more energy. Then and then you go, so what I'm going to do is bring on 5 more clients. Okay. Well, we're actually not solving the right problem here. Like if you bring on 5 more clients that now you're working later every night, or you've got to travel a bunch more, we just got further away from your goal, your objective. So when we get into these sort of preference-based questions, should I grow my business? Like it depends on what do you want? And we got to like figure out if what you want is actually what you want. And then we can answer the question. Now, the problem with that is it's not sexy and that's hard work, right? Just telling you to grow your business is easy. Here's 5 ways to get a bunch of clients, right? Go do that. But the business or your businesses exist to serve you. They exist to serve you. That's all. That's my belief. I call my clients purpose-driven entrepreneurs. So what I mean is your businesses, they have a purpose, and that purpose is to serve you in living the life that you want. So every decision needs to, this is my other, one of my other commandments, every decision you make in your business needs to get you closer to what you actually want.
Closer over more. Is that one of
them? Closer over more. Yeah. That's one of them. Yeah. So more clients may be the answer if it gets us closer to what we really want. And so the only way I can rig the game and engineer the outcome for you is if I actually know what we're solving for.
Wow.
And that takes a, it takes some upfront initial lifts, but once you figure that out, the rest is pretty easy. It's like we can solve for that problem.
Yeah, because most people are building their dream life around their business, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. You really want to build your business around your dream life. So it's very much in alignment with Jordan Peterson's build the schedule that you want. And once I realized that, and it maybe didn't happen overnight, I can set up the schedule that I truly want to look forward to. My Mondays look a certain way. My Tuesdays look a certain way. My Saturdays look a certain way. It makes you excited about what's ahead. Therefore, you know, you're making decisions. So you're not, like you said, hamstringing yourself to, you know, being tied to something that is not getting you to any type of promised land.
Yep. Yeah, the business exists to serve you. Why? Well, you started because you wanted freedom of some sort, right? Whatever that means to you. But many of us then set it up in a way where we serve the business. And that's just the wrong orientation. The business serves you. Every decision you're making, unless you made the decision to bring on a bunch of investors and do the whole, you know, venture capital, private equity, that's a different game. Then you serve your investors. I'm talking about small business owners. Your business exists to serve you. And that means your preferences matter and you're allowed to have them and want them because you want them. And that's sort of the as far as you really need to go.
Man. Great way to put it. Yeah. I think a lot of people, like you said, they say they want freedom. What's wild is that people think that when they quit their corporate job and start a business, that's freedom. But I do think of maybe, you know, it seems like you're a spiritual guy. Are you a God-fearing man?
I would say so. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you read the Bible at all?
I wouldn't say frequently, but I have. Yeah.
So in the Old Testament, it talks about how Moses frees the people, the Israelites, from the Egyptians, right? And are you familiar with this story?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's tyranny. And so it's pretty wild how this does correlate to entrepreneurship, but Moses frees the individuals because they want out of tyranny. They want out of prison, if you will. And then they go into the desert, but the desert's totally wide open and there's nothing there. And people would classify that as freedom, but freedom is extremely scary to most of those people, the Israelites. And so they start to worship false gods. They start to make bad decisions. There's snakes out there trying to bite them. They become very fearful and they start saying to themselves, I want to go back. It was safer there. There was food there. It was prison. It was hell. But at least I knew what I expected every day, right? So freedom is not that's not freedom. Freedom means options and whatnot. So yes, when you leave that corporate job or whatever, you go into the desert, but that's where you have to really find your character, find your, you know, who you really are. And it's on those times that you either, you know, strengthen your faith or lose it. And so after you build this business in the right way and it starts to serve you and you start to reap the rewards of your faith, that's whenever you can have your true freedom. So there are levels to this game and it doesn't happen overnight. Your freedom didn't come to you, I'm assuming, right away, but freedom is earned. Is that how you look at it too?
Yeah, there's a opening quote I have in the book that I think is related to what you were just sharing. It's from someone named Virginia Satir, and she says, people prefer the certainty of misery over the misery of uncertainty.
Oh, that's what we're talking so about. Good.
We'll go back to all the troubles and tribulations, and because it's what we know, because the unknown is so much scarier to us. Oh. But that's where the real upside is.
Yes. That's why you run into the unknown. That's why I look at entrepreneur. I have a phrase in my company, think like an entrepreneur. If you do that, you can win in any scenario. And therefore, you could see opportunity in chaos. And therefore, you can reap the rewards everywhere you go. Your economy around you doesn't really affect you if you can start to spot the cracks and weaknesses in the chaos. Mm-hmm. So, unknown is a great thing because most people are running from it. If you can learn to run towards it and not be afraid of it, that is what's going to set you apart. And your other commandment here, I want to touch on this before we run out of time. Business decisions should have asymmetric upside. All right. Yeah. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, this everything kind of builds to this in the essence of rigging the game. So when I talk about asymmetry I'm talking about. We want significantly more upside than downside. And if you study the great entrepreneurs, the people who have the wealth in the extreme, now we don't necessarily have to like them, but study the wealth in the extreme, what they tend to all have in common, aside from really playing their game and being incredibly eccentric, is that they have this gift of being able to identify opportunities that have huge, huge upside. They're like naturally calibrated to see these opportunities. And so many of us don't come equipped with that skill set to notice the upside, in large part because we're trained to not see it. We're trained to conform. We're trained to follow conventional methods. We are trained to put all of our excess capital in our 401k.
Yeah.
Okay. That's not asymmetry to the upside, though. Why? And I don't know anyone else who's talking about this, but maybe they're out there. If you tell me that you want to, you're 40 and you want to retire in the next 5 years, putting your excess capital in your 401k got you further away from that goal.
Oh,
that has significant
yeah.
downside. Why? Because you can't touch it until you're in your 60s. So all of that money that you put away, you just designed a system where you guarantee that you have to keep working. Okay. Once you hear that, you can't or see that, you can't unsee that. The reality that you've been building a system that guarantees you have to keep working, that's asymmetry to the downside. Now, I'm not against 401ks, just for the record. It's just not the first step. It's the last step. It's legacy. Your 401k money is legacy if you played the game correctly, because you didn't need that money because you were already good now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all just extra capital. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you. You know, it took me a little bit of time to realize that the school system, the corporate structure is teaching you everything. Rockefeller set it up. I look at it. So to keep you working, right? You know, make that cheese a little bit out of reach, and it just keeps getting a little bit further out of reach as you age.
100%. So we have to rewire our brains to be able to work through and try to find things where the upside is significantly greater. One way to do that is to remove all downside. So I think I mentioned earlier, my background originally was in this concept, derivatives and hedging. So a lot of what we do is just, hey, if we can remove all bad stuff, all downside, then all I'm left with is upside. So in every new endeavor that I go into, this is annoying for folks because we're trained to not think about the bad stuff, right? We just want, you're a pessimist, you're a skeptic. It's like, no, I'm playing a different game than you are. If I can eliminate all the bad stuff now, then I never have to talk about it again. I just have upside. You have this crazy volatility. Something that goes straight up has just as much volatility mathematically as something that goes straight down. We missed that. So I'm trying to engineer from the beginning, we eliminate all of those bad possibilities. So we just have that upside. But we are typically sold a different narrative. Have you heard the story of burn the boats?
Of course. Yes.
Yeah. So
it's the, I believe, is it not Romans, but it's maybe it's just the Vikings. If you want to, if you.
Yeah. So Cortez sails across the sea in battle with hundreds of men, ships, and he arrives at shores of this battle, and it looks, they're significantly outmanned. And so it looks like imminent demise. And so what does he do? He burns the boats, and he's forcing his men to have to go into battle, and they go on to win. And that is usually where people end the story. And they use that as a story to sell you on why you have to bet on yourself. Right? You got to burn the boats, go all in. And if you don't go all in at all times, then you're not putting yourself in the best position to win. But where the story, where people leave out a key part of the story, is that Cortez was told before he left, if you don't win this battle or you turn around, we're gonna kill you and all your men for treason.
Oh, wow.
So did he choose the riskiest bet, or did he choose the riskiest option or the least risky option?
The least risky.
He chose the least risky option, but that's not the narrative that we're taught. We're taught to take the riskiest option. So the game is to stay in the game. That is the game. Every time, so many small business owners, they keep taking themselves out of the game. They keep resetting because they're taking on too much risk. So eliminate all the downside where you can, but really only make bets where you have significant upside, because money is finite. There's an infinite number of trade-offs. I only want to make bets where I can stay in the game for longer than anyone else. And I only want to make bets where there's going to be significant returns. Because otherwise, when I tie up my money in one area, or my time or my energy, there's more than one currency in one area, I remove an infinite number of other things I could have been doing that potentially had more upside. Oh. So I got to be really intentional about what I'm opting into. And that's where the context matters, right? So when someone starts trying to sell me on a certain narrative, I'm like, am I really getting the full story here? Or are you just trying to hop me up on dopamine and get me into a sale? No disrespect to those people. I appreciate the game. But having that context is key.
Man, to stay in the game, one of the key characteristics of our company is just being able to withstand the storms. And I think that certain competitors out there have come and went. But if you're able to just stay in the game, I think people respect you more. Your marketplace value increases because you've been around for so long, right? And so people trust in you more. And if you could just withstand the storms and be here 5 years from now, the word of mouth alone will set you apart. And you make me think of an interview I just did with a guy who wrote a book called The Maverick Entrepreneur, Maverick Investor, something like that. And he talked about the movie The Maverick. Have you ever seen that? With Mel Gibson?
Okay. Yep. No. Yep.
He says that in the movie, Mel Gibson's sitting there and he tells all of the people at the card table, listen, I'm just going to play and I'll lose every hand for an hour. Is that cool? Can you get me into this game? And they're like, you're going to guarantee you're going to lose every hand for an hour? Of course. Come on in. And so he gets into the game and just basically gives up his money for an hour. And they look at him as a fool, like, oh, you're just basically giving us your money. Yeah. You can play with us.
Yeah, keep going.
And then after that hour, whatever time period it was, he starts changing his game. He goes, listen, guys, you allowed me to this game. And all I did was I studied you. I studied your telltale signs and who you are as people and how you play this game. And I was around long enough to understand how I can win. And now I'm going to turn it on and beat you guys. So he got into the game, but he was able to withstand certain other people from being knocked out just by playing the bare minimum, right? And what's cool about that is it kind of does kind of show you that as an entrepreneur, your goal is to learn the game. And to do that, you can't go all in with all your money in every situation. Be around for as long as possible. Stay in the game so you learn yourself, you learn your clients, you learn marketing. And 5 years later, it's not a get rich quick, it's a get rich for certain if you just stay in the game and just develop your skills as you go. So that is an awesome takeaway. And I see how it kind of correlates with that movie. Hopefully you're able to see how it matches up too.
Totally. And I would just sort of play off that. And I know we're kind of maybe at time. So if I could just share one final thing here.
Please do. Yeah.
Because it's the essence of how I kind of think about designing the game to get the outcome that you want. So there's this another quote from this guy, W. Edwards Deming. He's kind of an OG in the corporate world and systems, kind of a systems thinking. And he says, every system is perfectly designed for the results it gets. Perfectly designed for the results it's getting, paraphrasing loosely. So if you don't like the results you're getting, you have three options. These are my words now. You have three options. Option one, this is what most people do, probably not in this group, probably not people who listen to your podcast, just getting a sense of who you are. But what most people are going to do, they're going to choose the certainty of misery. They're going to be a victim. For me, this is just how it is. I don't have any options. This is just happening to me. So that's just accepting the certainty of misery. You're never going to get the outcome that you want because you're just resigned to it. But the next two options will, depending. Number one, can I change the system? So in the case of taxes, I can't change the system, at least not on the timeline that's going to be acceptable to me. I'd have to get elected and sell my soul and do a bunch of other stuff that I don't want to do. And so I can't change the system within my timeline. But things that I've set up in my business, maybe I can change the system. I have control over that. So can I change the system? If you can, that's going to be the highest leverage because you control the system now. But most of the time, the answer is no, I can't. And that means that we have to learn the system and then change our behavior to get the outcome that we want. So just like in that anecdote you shared from Maverick, I learned the system. Here's how everyone is playing. Now that I know that system, I can rig it because I'm going to modify my behavior to get the outcome that I want. And that's, to me, rigging the game.
Oh, it's awesome. I heard a quote recently from somebody's podcast, and I think it goes along these lines. People will always rise to the level of their standards, but they will always fall to the level of their processes. And man, did that hit home, because you can have everything great with branding, marketing, business, but if you have shitty processes and, you know, SOPs and not everybody's playing by the same rules within the company, it just becomes a mess. So yeah, understanding the importance of having processes in place. Man, it's very good stuff. I could talk to you for hours, sir.
Yeah, you too.
So outside of your own book, this is the last question I have for you. Is there another book that you recommend to our audience? I always bring up Rich Dad, Poor Dad, because it is the one that set me absolutely free as a person. That's why I pay homage to it to this day. It's always sitting behind me. So anything like that for you, sir?
I'm going to recommend How to Fly a Horse. And it is written by the inventor of the Internet of Things. And he really inspired me around how innovation and creativity really exists. He just demystifies a lot of false narratives around creativity. Wow. So I think it's a must read.
How to Fly a Horse. I've never heard of that book. So yeah. I'm going to check that out. Oh man, I am going to listen to your book. I run pretty much 25 miles per week. I've been listening to a lot of podcasts. I'm going to put your book on because I'm fascinated. Did you read your book? Please tell me it's in your voice.
It's one of my great regrets is that I had someone else do it. But
got it. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. When it comes to personal branding, you know, I just, you know, I think that you could have AI redo it in your voice, just so you know. But
it's anyways. One of those things that's on my list of either redoing it, or I've got another book I'm considering that's kind of in the works. So if I do that, I will definitely due to my own dry monotone voice.
Well, I think you have a good way of communicating it. So hopefully it just shines through in the audio version, because I'll check it out. And like I said, I listen to podcasts, but I'll be picking up your book on my run for this week.
I appreciate
it. You're such I guess you could say a logical and smart dude. I just have no idea why you're still out in Seattle. I just hear that's a war zone. What are you doing out there, man?
Man, I feel like that's one of those false narratives as well. I grew up in the Seattle area, and when it was a very blue collar town, and we were known for being weird. Like Seattle's weird because we just all this quirky stuff that exists. So that's still Seattle to me. Everyone is just kind of an introvert out here. We got all these computers. So funny to me that people think that we're just out raging in the streets. Like there is a group of people who are doing that, but like if you knew Seattle people, you're like, most of us don't want to like leave our house. We're all like computer science nerds and all that. So there's something called the Seattle freeze, which is just like it's really hard if you move out here to meet people because everyone is so to themselves. So it's funny to me that there's a narrative that Seattle's just like.
Well, you are the birthplace for grunge. So I will say I tip my hat to you guys for that, because I grew up listening to Nirvana and Offspring. I think Offspring came from there and Pearl Jam. So yeah, there is one good thing. And
I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So our claim to fame is, you know what? It's shitty weather here, but it's not as rainy and dreary as it is in Seattle. That's what we kept saying.
That's your Salem pitch. Well, I still hate Pittsburgh because the Steelers Seahawks Super Bowl years ago where we got totally jobbed by the refs. This is my pitch for Seattle since you were just sticking it to us. We are a population of independent thinkers.
So, is that real? I don't know. Yeah. I hear the opposite. Yeah. Just so you
That's
know.
That's why you see a lot of Starbucks, Microsoft, Amazon, like all the innovation that comes out of Seattle. And then you have, you know, a wide range of political things, but that only comes from a place where you got a bunch of independent thinkers. So there is a narrative that we're just like these wackadoo socialists that we're just like, but if you stop and think about it, you're like the highest per capita millionaires are like, well, the number of Fortune 500 companies, there's an area of billionaires. Like we have, it's like, doesn't sound very socialist when you start breaking down like how many rich people live here.
Yeah. I guess it makes sense that maybe it's just the pockets, you know, it's very much like you just, as long as you stay out of San Francisco, you should be okay. Right. It's been these pockets.
Yeah. Those guys are crazy. Those guys. Yeah. But, you know, it's been a real bummer to see the narrative for me shift because I feel like 5 years ago, people thought like, oh, Seattle's this cool place. Like, yeah, grunge came from here. There's a bunch of cool companies, technology. And then we had all the political stuff happen and the narrative has really shifted where people are like, oh, you're from Seattle. You must be like a nutcase. It's like, well, that might be true, but for reasons different than what you think.
Yeah. I think the first Starbucks was in Seattle. Pretty sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it started here. Headquarters is here.
Yeah.
Wireless started here.
So as long as you get your message out there and transform your area, maybe you'll change the culture and, you know, shift everything back.
We're just a bunch of independent thinkers. So sometimes we're going to do some crazy stuff. That's my pitch. But yeah,
man, it's fun. It's fun to talk with you. I don't know when this next book is coming out. So please, when it does come out, come back on, okay?
Right on. I will let you know. Appreciate you.
Is there a social media channel or a website people can look up and get connected with
you? Yeah, if you go riggingthegame.com, you can find my stuff. Or if you go to, they haven't shut me down yet. So if you go to riggingamazon.com, it'll take you to my book on Amazon.
Riggingamazon.com, you have that.
I own that domain. I keep thinking. I'm going to get a cease and desist letter, but it hasn't happened yet.
I would expect, Jeff Bezos, if he's listening, he's a good guy. Lay off sending him that cease and desist. So,
yeah, come on. What have I done to you, Jeff? I just bought your products and subscribed to your Amazon Prime. The least you could do is let me on Rigging Amazon.
Yeah, you just want that SEO magic. That's it. That's how you rig the game.
That's right.
All right, man. Thanks so much. Dan Nicholson, everybody. Rigging the Game, How to Achieve Financial Certainty, Navigate Risk, and Make Money on Your Own Terms. Pick it up today. 258 reviews on Amazon. It's definitely resonating, and I'm going to check it out today. So it means a lot for him to be here. And remember, guys, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.